Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr.
And I'm Rudio Bias, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies.
That's right. We've got Rudy back on the show. He was on, it was earlier this year, I believe you were on. I forget what we were talking about, but you've been on several times. Rudy's an old fan, a friend of the show. I don't know if he's a fan of the show. I'd like to think he's a fan of the show.
Yes, I am a fan. I look forward to listening to Fat Guys at the Movies every Friday when it comes into my iTunes catcher.
Good. And you actually listen to it, not just download it. And that's what we're always.
No, I listen to it. You're one of the many podcasts that I listen to on a weekly basis.
That's awesome. But it's always great to have Rudy back with us. This is how you can get a hold of we'll talk a little bit about Rudy and some more of Rudy's history and where you can find him. But first, let's get through the paperwork here. You can go to fatguysatthemovies.com. And search us, and our podcasts are all there. The entire Fat Guys Network is up there. You can go to iTunes and search Fat Guys at the Movies, or you can search Fat Guys Network, and all of our shows pop up. You can go to facebook.com/FGATM, and our email is fatguys@filmschoolrejects.com. Our voicemail is 740-205-6456. We don't have any big emails or voicemails this week. Everybody's out watching the Avengers, apparently.
Multiple times Rudy, watching the Avengers.
Apparently that's what's happening, yeah. So Rudy, tell us, remind everybody who you are, where you come from, what you do, and where people can find you.
Well, I'm a movie blogger living here in beautiful New York City. I am the movies editor for Shakya.com, and I am the host of my own podcast, The AutorCast, which is a pretty erudite, film snobby type of podcast.
which is why I'm not on it.
We'll get you on there one day. We'll get you on there. When we talk about John Carpenter movies, we'll definitely get you on for that.
Yes, John Carpenter.
But we won't have you on when we talk about The Tree of Life, because I know how much you hate that movie.
No, and then I'd have to go and watch all of Terrence Malick's stuff, and I don't know if I've got the endurance for all that.
But you can find all my work at rudiobias.com, or go to shakya.com or autorcast.com to find all my work.
So there's various options out there, which is great. So good to have Rudy back on the show. Always fine. You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/KevinCarr. And it's for you, it's Rudy Obias. It's twitter.com/Rudy_Obias, correct?
That is correct.
All right. And or I like to call you Rudio. To me, you're a breakfast cereal from the 80s. Rudio's.
I'm waiting for someone to like draw me a logo of me as a breakfast cereal from the 80s. I think I'll get that tattooed on my arm or something.
It would be like the Mr. T breakfast cereal. And it could have you just sitting there. You could have chains and be like, I pity the fool, punch, Rudio. And you'd be punching through the giant O.
It's because I'm just as threatening as Mr. T.
I bet you in person. You are terrifying in person. You are an imposing figure.
Yes, it's pretty anyway. Pretty meek Asian guy. pretty terrifying.
Anyways, let's talk a little bit about. We really don't have anything. There's only one movie opening this week. Wide. I mean, there's like Girl in Progress. Isn't that what it is? That's Eva Mendes' movie. That's opening. I haven't had a chance to see it. I don't know if you want to talk about it. But. Really, the only thing is the big news is the Avengers is just ripping apart the box office. It did record numbers last week, and it did 19 million on Monday and 18 million on Tuesday. These are not insignificant figures. They are the kind of figures that you get on like a Sunday after a big hit.
Yeah, it seems like some movies would just be happy getting 18 million for their general box office weekend, you know?
Yeah.
And they're getting that in like on a Tuesday, you know, like when generally no one really goes to a movie.
Yeah. It's amazing how huge this is. Did you like the Avengers? Were you a fan of the show or the movie?
I love the Avengers. I actually saw it twice already, and I plan to see it another time this week.
Did you check it out in IMAX? Cause you got a full fledged IMAX there in New York. I'm sure.
No, I didn't. Both times I saw it in 3D, I haven't checked it out in IMAX yet, but I'm sure the Hulk is just as big on that IMAX screen as he is on every screen I've seen him on. But I love The Avengers. It's a fantastic film. It's a fun ride, and both times I've seen it, I just get a kick out of just watching how this unfolds and how this all comes together. Because honestly, I didn't think this was going to ever happen. I didn't think Marvel would ever get to a point where they're making the Avengers after making Iron Man. I mean, this is just stuff comic book geeks dream about. And here it is, the Avengers. And the thing is, everyone loves it. And that's what I love about this movie as well.
What's funny is when I was putting my review up on Rotten Tomatoes, my pull quote I used was, "It is a giant roast of awesome wrapped up in bacony awesomeness." Now, you're a vegetarian, so you can't partake in the bacony awesomeness, but that's what I thought. I'm just like, it is just awesome wrapped up in more awesome.
Yes, and plus you have the Hulk smashing that awesome into a million pieces.
Oh yeah, he's great. The Hulk is great in this. I've always loved the Hulk, and one of the reasons I like the Hulk is it's probably the most identifiable character. Because as much as everyone wants to put on the Iron Man suit and fly around, we can all identify with what it's like to Hulk out, to just sit there and be just so mad and just brr. And I do that all the time at home, and I turn green and my shorts turn purple, and I start ripping things off the wall. I do have a tendency to be a bit Hulk smashy. When I do lose my temper, and I have quite a temper.
So. And it's interesting, like this is like the third iteration of the Hulk, but it seems like it gets this one right. You know, I mean, I like the Ang Lee version of the Hulk. I'm not so keen on the Incredible Hulk, but I love Mark Ruffalo and I love Mark Ruffalo's Hulk, and I love him in the Avengers.
Yeah, well, it was fun. That's funny because I remember when I was going through all the Marvel movies, I was tweeting out about that, and you're just like, "Oh, better than that Incredible Hulk." And you're one of the few people I've met that like Ang Lee's Hulk better than the Incredible Hulk that they made in 2008.
Yeah, I mean, I think both movies are pretty bad, but if gun to my head, if I had to choose one, I think I would go with Ang Lee's The Hulk, because I like Ang Lee as a filmmaker, and I understand what he was trying to go for in The Hulk, the movie he came out in 2003. I don't think he was very successful in doing that, but I find it to be just an interesting failure in a way, and that's why I think I just appreciate that movie for what it is.
I think that's a good way to do it. It's an interesting failure. It is an epic failure in what he's trying to do, because... And people forget that this was at the time when they were making Daredevil. You know, that's what Marvel Studios was doing. And while they're doing the Spider-Man movies and the early X-Men films then, they still were floundering about a bit, and they were pulling the DC game where they didn't know what exactly they were going to do. And so you throw this thing, and Ang Lee tried to do something different, and like you said, it was a failure, and suddenly you're like, "Oh, look, moss and lichen, and here's a starry sky, and he's going to Hulk out because he remembered something he didn't like." I personally like the Incredible Hulk better, but I like you said, the Mark Ruffalo version, he's a fantastic Hulk.
Oh yeah.
And really can embody, and he embodies both the Hulk character and the Bruce Banner character.
And that was really the one thing I was worried about going into it, but I'm not worried anymore. I mean, I think we can all agree. We all love the Hulk because of this movie.
Yep. Yeah, we had Melissa Molina on last week, and she was gushing about the Avengers. We just had to do a little more gushing today because, holy cow, nobody saw this thing coming. And congratulations to everybody involved. But at this point, we're going to go to a break, and when we get back, we're going to leave the Avengers behind, and we're going to talk about the one new movie that's opening this week wide, Dark Shadows. And welcome back to Fat Guys in the Movies. We were talking a little bit about Avengers in the last piece. Don't worry, Marvel fans. We will get back to talking about Avengers soon enough when we hit the box office segment. But right now we are going to talk about the only new movie that's coming out this weekend that's going into wide release, and that is Dark Shadows, in which Tim Burton and Johnny Depp put in their dark, whimsical spin on the classic gothic daytime drama.
My name is Barnabas Collins. 2 centuries ago, I made Collinwood my home.
Hear me, future dweller. What is the year?
1972.
1972. My beloved Collinwood.
I'm a vampire, madam.
Yeah.
He's not staying with us forever, is he?
I like him.
Oh, super fat.
Welcome home, Barnabas Collins.
How soon can the horses be ready?
We don't have horses. We have a Chevy.
You first, Rudy. I want to know what you thought about this, because you actually had a chance to see this a couple days ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, my background, I guess I'll start with my background with Tim Burton. I'm not that big of a fan of his work, but I'm always willing to give him a shot. And I didn't think this movie was great, but at the same time, I didn't think this movie was bad. I think it's just right there in the middle, and that's really how I find a lot of Tim Burton films to begin with. They just seem to be right there in the middle. Not good, not great, but also not bad, not horrible. And for that, I think I enjoyed Dark Shadows a little bit, but at times it did feel a little boring and tedious. What did you think of this movie?
This is well, first, my general views on Tim Burton, just so I'm out there, because I know there's a lot of hate out there for Tim Burton, and a lot of it comes from the critical community, and I hear people not in the critical community poo-poo him a lot, but he definitely has his fans. I would consider myself one of his fans. In general, 9 times out of 10, when I see a Tim Burton movie, I don't just like it, I do thoroughly enjoy it. Even the ones that people really rip apart. Like, I liked Alice in Wonderland. I thought it was an interesting take on everything. Yeah, it sort of went down a lot of the same roads that Tim Burton goes down, but I enjoyed it. I liked Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Heck, I even liked Planet of the Apes. I haven't seen it in a while, so maybe I'll revisit it and it'll be terrible. But I was okay with that. This one, not so much. And I think There's a couple things that I had a problem with. The first is there just didn't seem to be a focus. The story Definitely. Being Barnabas Collin, yeah, Barnabas Collin was you know, ran Collinwood in the 1700s, and then he was cursed and made a vampire and buried, and he comes back, and it's 1972, and he's trying to defeat the woman the witch who gave him this curse, and kind of get his family back together. It really feels like, though, it felt like the result of a brainstorming session that never went beyond the brainstorming session. So it had all these ideas thrown out there, like, oh, let's make it a comedy, a fish out of water thing, where we're going to play pop, you know, the rock music of the day and show the juxtaposition. No, we're going to make it a gothic movie. No, we're going to make it a love story. No, we're going to make the family abhorrent. No, we're going to make the family somebody you care about. We're going to make Barnabas Collin cool. We're going to make Barnabas Collin making genital jokes. You know what I mean? So it's just like they had so many directions it was trying to go, and it just didn't pick one.
Yeah,
I
agree with that. That I feel that, like, the plotting of this movie was kind of all over the place. Like, it didn't seem focused at all. Like, I agree with you to that extent. Like, well, now they're trying to save the family company, and now he's falling in love, and now he's not falling in love. And wait a minute, we still have family members we have to take care of. I really just chalked that up to the source material of how. I mean, this movie did feel very soap, like it felt like a soap opera, and I think that is what the source material was. And so I think going in those general directions is what the film was trying to do. I don't know if it succeeded, but I understand the direction of where it was trying to get at. But I can see how that could be very, very boring, or just because you really can't latch on to any one storyline in this movie because there's just so many of them.
Yeah. Now, have you ever watched the original Dark Shadows from the 60s and 70s?
No, not at all.
Yeah, it's interesting because it is on Netflix Instant. So if you have a Netflix Instant account, you can check it out. And it's almost worth watching simply because you're going to get certain parts of not even jokes or thing, but you're going to, like, there's a sequence in there that after he wakes up from being asleep for 200 years, he shows up at Collinwood and he runs into Michelle Pfeiffer and they have this big long discussion, and it's very oddly shot for a contemporary film. It's a lot of over the shoulder shots and people looking away, and they're talking and they're rambling on and on and on. There's really, it feels like it's a meandering scene, and that scene's going to bore most modern audiences. In watching that scene, I'm like, oh, I get what they're doing, because that's how Dark Shadows was shot. It was not a high budget show. It was literally a daily serial that was a half hour each, but they did that, you know, it was like General Hospital was in the 60s.
Yeah.
It was just cranked out. So a lot of it was dialogue. There wasn't a whole lot of editing. It was just people standing around talking, and they captured that. But unless you've actually seen it, and let's face it, the show hasn't been on the air for what, 40 years, 45 years, 40 years or so. if you haven't seen that, then that'll be lost on you. It'll just be a boring scene.
Well, if that scene, for example, I think it's pretty indicative of the entire film, where that scene, it's building up with this dialogue between Michelle Pfeiffer's character and Johnny Depp's character, and then we get a glimpse of what's behind her back. There's this knife, and we have an idea what she's going to do with it. We're just waiting for her to do something with it, and that's pretty much this whole movie. We know what's behind Tim Burton's back. We know what this movie is going to do. We're just waiting for it to do it. And it never really does anything. How that scene ends, there's no payoff to what happens in that scene, and there's no payoff of how this whole movie is overall.
Yeah. Well, and in particular, the movie becomes a bit of a metaphor of itself near the end, because there's a scene where, let's just say, a building's crumbling, and it's a metaphor of the plot, just completely crumbling and falling apart and all this stuff kind of coming out of nowhere, and that's kind of what they do. And I get that they kind of tried to take the entire Dark Shadows serial, which lasted for several years and amassed something thousands of like 1,000 or 1,500 episodes because it was a daily serial, and they tried to cram all this into a 2-hour movie, and they kind of tried to hit all the beats, which didn't quite work. It's sort of like if you were watching True Blood. And you know that eventually in True Blood they have witches and shapeshifters and werewolves. If you watch the first season of True Blood, it's just vampires. And at the very end, they kind of be like, oh, it's a bigger world. There's not just vampires. There's werewolves and other shapeshifters. But it's like them trying to cram all that into the pilot of the episode. And that's kind of what this felt like. And the other thing is, I don't know, I mean, for as much as Johnny Depp and Tim Burton say they're fans of the series, it wasn't very much like the series, because it was making fun of the series. It was doing what they did with the Brady movie, the very Brady movie, where they suddenly said, well, let's make it a goofy, wacky comedy. And I'm like, Dark Shadows wasn't, I mean, it was campy, but it was campy not because it was deliberately trying to be silly. The old TV show was campy because it was made for like $15 an episode, and they had, you know, it was like an Ed Wood set where, you know, the castle was made out of cardboard.
You make an interesting point with the Brady Bunch movies, and those movies are definitely parodies, and they're poking fun at the style of the 70s. This movie doesn't really take a firm stance on that. It tiptoes around it and it kind of plays around with it. But what makes the Brady Bunch a better movie? Because it's more fun, and it commits to that joke, where in Dark Shadows, this movie, it doesn't commit to it. But I think there are things that I liked with the movie. I think generally the kitschiness of it, that's the kind of stuff that I enjoyed of this film. I think it wasn't so much campy as it was kitschy, and I enjoyed just the way this movie looked. I think that's pretty much really the only positives I had with this film, and ultimately I feel really disappointed that there just could have been more. I mean, this movie is supposed to be fun, but it wasn't at all.
Yeah, it was a misfire in a lot of ways. You're right. It, like all Tim Burton movies, it looks fantastic. I mean, it has a really interesting style, a very typical Tim Burton style, but there were things. Now, first of all, you're right, it's not terrible. I mean, it's okay. It's probably not going to be the worst vampire movie you'll see this year.
Yeah.
Because we've got another one coming up in November that everyone, you know, but it's also, there's some, and they did some weird things, like Chloe Moretz. I think they overuse, I'm so tired of the surly, sallow teenage girl, just because they got one of those on every TV show out there, but they like really sexualize her in this movie.
Yeah.
In a very PG-13 sort of way.
And it's interesting, because I went into this thinking it was going to be like the Addams Family, and then Chloe Moretz was going to be something like Wednesday Addams in this movie, but she's not. She is completely sexualized, which is kind of weird because she's like 14, 15 years old, and I don't want to look at her that way.
And she plays a 15-year-old girl, because she even says it at one point. She's like, I'm 15. And I'm like, whoa. And they really do. Yeah, so it made me feel a little bit uncomfortable with the way they were doing it. And I think you bring up Addams Family. Addams Family is a great thing, that a great example of a movie. And I'll just say this because we got to go to a break. Addams Family was something that played off an old TV show that was limited by budget, and they went goofy and crazy and very stylized, but it still felt like the Addams Family.
Yeah, and that's kind of what they should have done here with Dark Shadows.
Yeah. And on that, we got to go to a break.
22 miles of hard road, 33 years of tough luck. 44 skulls buried in the ground, crawling down through the muck. Oh, yeah.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. We were just talking about Dark Shadows. Off the air and on the air.
Yeah, and I wanted to jump back in because we were mentioning a couple things. We can talk a little bit more about Dark Shadows in the sense that it being what I'd said off the air was I just was kind of bored. I didn't like any of the characters. I was even Barnabas Collins. A part of it is a Jonathan Frid who played him in the original series. He was just so deliciously villainous but gray. And I mean, as great of an actor as Johnny Depp is, I don't think he didn't capture that, really.
I had this thought while watching Dark Shadows with Johnny Depp playing Barnabas Collins, mm-hmm. and I was thinking to myself, if they ever make the Michael Jackson biopic movie, Johnny Depp should play Michael Jackson.
He totally should.
You know, like the older Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
They should get like Donald Glover to play the young Michael Jackson, like the Thriller Michael Jackson, and then later in his life, Johnny Depp plays him.
15 years later, suddenly there's Johnny Depp.
Because he looked like Michael Jackson in this movie, didn't he? Like the way he's wearing the hat and the umbrella, I was like, that's so, and the sunglasses, I'm like, this is Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
Come on, who are we kidding?
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah, well, especially then, especially those scenes. You know, you expected him to dangle a baby at one point. So, but yeah, and here's the other thing with Dark Shadows. Tim Burton's a huge fan of horror films and creepy movies. And all of his movies reflect that. And like I said, I like Tim Burton. I would like to see him just make a full-fledged horror movie one day. I would like to see him make, like, the good old-fashioned Vincent Price, Pit in the Pendulum, do all your stylized things, but don't go for the camp and the goofiness and the King's, you know, the King's Island showmanship kind of thing. Go for just a good, solid, honest, scary movie. And I think he would be freaking
I think he tried to do that though with Sleepy Hollow. I think Sleepy Hollow was his stab at doing, because there are parts of Sleepy Hollow that it's not very campy. Some of it does feel pretty scary, and I think that was his attempt to do that type of horror film.
Well, and I think also Sweeney Todd was a bit like that, even though he was working under the confines of a musical. He was sort of true to it wasn't a silly version of Sweeney Todd. It was still they were singing, you know, so it wasn't as taken as seriously. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, there were parts I liked about it, and maybe when I watch it again, I'll like it better. I just wasn't. It was just one of those things that just didn't grab me, and that's odd because I'm a big defender of his. You know, I'll watch movies all the time that he does, and I'll be like, no, I liked him. You know, I'm not one of the, there's so many people out there just hate Tim Burton, and they'll be like, oh, all he does is remakes and adaptations and stuff, and well, that I don't think defines a bad filmmaker, because you know I actually pointed out to somebody, you know, Kubrick, Spielberg, Fincher, and Peter Jackson all have been doing adaptations and remakes most of their careers.
Yeah, and I don't think there's anything wrong with adapt. If you want to do, all you want to do is adapt books and other properties, I think that's fine, as long as you make a good movie. A good movie is a good movie. And I give him a little shadow of a doubt, because I feel that, you know, he can put a film together, he can it always looks good, and there should be something more interesting there, but for the most part, how I feel about Tim Burton in general is that all of his films are just so middle of the road for me.
Yeah,
that there's not that much to get excited for, except the way it generally looks.
Yeah, he suffers from what a lot of filmmakers suffer from. Michael Bay suffers from this, being very visual and just really into the visuals and having a very specific style. But usually, when the thing that is lacking first is characters.
Yeah, and both Michael Bay and Tim Burton have their fans and defenders, but they also have the people who hate them a lot. Oh,
and people hate them, so yeah. Anyways, when it comes to this movie, I'm actually going to say for the Fat Guys grade for this one, I'm giving it a kind of sucks, simply because I was just a bit disinterested in it. I think it could have been cool if they actually would have done a serious try at this and not gone for the camp. And it's sort of like they traumatized it. In the sense that they said, let's go for the camp as opposed to just the way they make it ends up becoming camp. It's sort of trying to manufacture cheesiness.
Yeah, I think the fat guy grade I would give it would be kind of sucks as well. Not because it's not that good of a movie, but it's also a vampire movie. And I want to throw that little play on words there.
There you go. Kind of sucks. All right. I need a trombone. And then we'll just pull it back in with a slide whistle. Whoop. Yeah. Anyways, let's move on and talk box office. We're going to go back talking about the Avengers. Holy shit. $207 million for the weekend box office. Did you even see this coming?
No, I did not. I mean, I was thinking $150 million maybe, like what was ever projected. And even that I felt was kind of generous.
Yeah.
But $200 million, like blowing blowing all the competition out of the water and having that box office record and even blowing out the Harry Potter and Deathly Hallows Part 2 record out of the water. I didn't see that coming at all.
Yeah, it was. And what was interesting about it is when it started showing through and they said it was like when they reported the midnight numbers at 18 million, I saw some people being like, oh, I was expecting more. Well, it made up for it throughout Friday and Saturday and Sunday. And then they're saying, well, this could be as much as 160, 175 million for the weekend. And then when they came out with the number, Disney reported, this is actually shrewd of Disney. They lowballed their Sunday and they said, I think Disney knew it had enough numbers that they were confident it was going to make over 200 million. But they said, let's just say 200 and change. So it's just barely over 200. Just in case if it comes in low, they can be like, well, we were close. But they got all those articles. But then when it came in, it made an extra $7 million off of the initial estimate, which is uncanny. It is so huge that it has a good shot at being the only movie ever made that will make $100 million in its second weekend.
Well, and the thing about the Avengers, which I find is pretty outstanding, is this wasn't a sure thing. No. Like Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, that's kind of a sure thing that's going to make money.
Yeah. End of
there
the
were
entire
a lot
series,
of doubts that this movie was going to get made or if it was going to make that much money at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was one of those that, yeah, going in, they didn't know. And it reminds me a little bit of like when Avatar came out. Because a lot of people, when Avatar came out, there was a lot of people saying, well, it should make some money. And then when the first numbers were reported, it made 70 some million its first weekend. And people were like, well, that was good, but it wasn't huge. And then it just had staying power. And that's when Avatar impressed, not in its opening weekend, but in its second weekend and third weekend and fourth weekend. And that's kind of what Avengers did on a daily basis. It's like then people realized how good it was doing. It did so well. Just a little bit of inside baseball for people out there. Disney is extremely they're extremely tight with their embargoes. Now, a lot of people just ignore them anyways. But Disney almost always does not want early reviews running, and especially for lower critics. I mean, like the Hollywood Reporter will put stuff out, but that's because it's the Hollywood Reporter. But especially from regional reps, they'll ask you to hold it till opening day. And our screening was on Tuesday. We got an email right before I left for the screening, and it says, oh, yeah, you can run your reviews whenever. And I'm like, well, and at this point, Disney knows it's going to make a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, it already made a lot of money internationally.
Yeah.
But even with that an early international box office, I really didn't think it was going to make this kind of money.
Yeah,
I'm happy. I'm really happy for Joss Whedon because he's the kind of guy. I know you're not a fan of Joss Whedon. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to hold that against you, but he really deserved to have a win sometime in his career.
Well, and let me say this in terms of me not being a fan of Joss Whedon, I'm not a fan of his work. I've never met the guy. From what I understand, he's a great guy, and also he fosters a real sense of camaraderie with any project he touches. And I respect that. I don't think you get that enough in Hollywood. So, yeah, I'm glad he got this huge hit. Now it's like, what the hell is he going to do next? You know, is he going to do an Avengers 2? I think he'll do a smaller piece. I think he'll want to do I wouldn't be surprised if he did, like, Dr. Horrible 2.
I would – like anything he would do, I would be on board. Serenity 2, I would be very happy with that.
I see. Now, I think Serenity 2 would be a huge mistake. Not because I didn't like it, but because if they say, let's make a sci-fi movie by the guy who directed this billion-dollar movie, because it will be a billion-dollar movie, let's get the guy who directed this billion-dollar movie to make Serenity 2, and then you have to... first of all, as great as Joss Whedon did with this film, the draw was not Joss Whedon. The people seeing this were seeing it for Iron Man, Hulk, Thor, Captain America. Those are the reason people were seeing it. And there were some people who were seeing it for Joss Whedon, but his name was not the biggest name on the poster.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. But there are definitely Joss Whedon fans out there that went to see this movie because it was a Joss Whedon movie, not necessarily because it was a Marvel movie.
And all of them went and saw Serenity.
when I went to see this movie, my concern was, being a Joss Whedon fan, was this movie going to fit in Joss Whedon's catalog? Was this going to be like a Joss Whedon movie, or was he going to be just a gun for hire? And it's very much so a Joss Whedon movie. Like, practically every theme and trope that he tackles in all of his movies or TV shows is right here in The Avengers.
Well,
down to what you said about family, having a group of misfits come together as family, all of his properties have that element to them, yeah. And it's right here in The Avengers as well.
Well, I think that his history of writing comic books and his love for comic books, and I think he was given properties that were mainstream properties, and they weren't his, so it didn't, for lack of a better term, it didn't reek of Joss Whedon. You know, it did not feel like, it didn't necessarily feel like Firefly or Serenity. You could see all the influences there, but it wasn't niche. And I think
he restrained himself.
Yeah,
he definitely restrained himself with this one.
Yeah, and I think that worked. And I think it's because, having worked for so many years in television and working as a writer for other people, he's been a writer for hire for decades. It's actually was good for him because he respects the process. He's like, okay, these are actual characters that other people developed and other people worked on and other people started in these films. I'm going to be respectful to that. And I think that boded well for this film. And that's part of the reason why it works so well, because it is a Joss Whedon film, but it's also one of the films that's completely fits within this Marvel universe that they've created over the last five films that he had nothing to do with.
Yeah, I think one criticism of The Avengers that I'll say, I'm not a big fan of the score of The Avengers.
I've heard
I think
a
it's a pretty generic
complain,
score.
Yeah.
What I wish they would have done, like starting off with Iron Man and continued it all through the Marvel movies, was have the same composer do the music for all these Marvel movies, but then have Iron Man's theme, have Hulk's theme, have Thor and Captain America's theme. And then when they get to The Avengers, put all those themes together into one piece of music, yeah. And then that would be the Avengers theme. I think that would have been the most clever thing ever if they would have thought of that in 2007 when they initially started doing the Iron Man movie.
Yeah, you know, you're right. I think that would have been an interesting way of doing it, definitely. But yeah, no, I've heard other people say that the score, I mean, the score worked for me. It didn't jump out at me as being a good score or a bad score. But what I did like about it is, I would prefer a just fantastically awesome movie with a acceptable score than an okay movie with a fantastic score. Take like The Last Airbender, which was terrible. It has a great score.
that score is fantastic. It's the best part of the movie.
It just feels so out of place in the film because it's so good. Whereas this one was adequate. I didn't think it was bad. It just was. It wasn't iconic. You know.
Yeah, it was a little uninspired. I mean, it got the job done, you know. I mean, it invoked emotions when it's supposed to invoke emotions. But I don't know. I mean, part of me wants to have that Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, type of theme. I mean, when was the last time we had a score that was like Raiders of the Lost Ark or Back to the Future or any iconic or Superman, you know, that you hear it and you know exactly what it is and you know exactly how to feel because of it.
Yeah, even like take like The Dark Knight, which has a great score, or even more so Inception, which is even more recognizable score. It's not the It's not the thing that'll work its way into pop culture. It works for the film. And in fact, there's a great example. Inception, which is a good movie, I felt at times the score overpowered the film because the score was so perfect and the movie is good. I didn't think it was perfect. There were some flaws in it, but I thought, I mean, the score was almost, you almost remember the score more than you remember the film at times. So
yeah,
but you're right. I mean, John Williams, you know, he's the guy who can get those iconic scores. I mean, even people like, you know, before him, you had like Bernard Herrmann with Psycho and was it, did Herrmann do Day the Earth Stood Still, which is a very iconic score?
Yes, I believe so. Yeah. But even with Tim Burton films with Danny Elfman, you have, yeah, having his Batman score, which is a pretty great score,
oh,
I feel.
Beautiful, yeah.
But even in Dark Shadows, like that, and Danny Elfman did the music for Dark Shadows. I mean, it's, you know, there's really, it's just a typical Danny Elfman type of score for a typical Tim Burton film.
I couldn't hum the theme from Dark Shadows to you right now. I couldn't hum three beats, three notes of anything in the background score of that movie. That's kind of how unimpactful that was. So what do you think's going to? Oh, go on.
Oh, I was just going to say, but you can hum the score for his Tim Burton's Batman though.
Oh yeah, like that. Oh yeah. I won't treat you to that. Because it'll sound really dumb coming from me, but no, I would recognize it immediately. But so, what do you think is going to win this weekend? I mean, I think it's a pretty fair bet that Avengers is going to continue.
Yeah, even if Avengers drops off by 50%, it's still going to be $100 million box office, yeah,
which is unheard.
And I don't think it's going to drop any more than 50. You know, I don't think it's going to be a 60% drop. Even if it's a 60% drop off. You know, that's still like $80 million right there.
Yeah, well, and I looked up on Box Office Mojo, I looked up the all the movies that had these huge opening weekends, these 100 million plus opening weekends. And all of them, with the exception, I think, of the last Twilight movie, maybe one other one, but the last Twilight movie was the only one that did this. And that's because it was very front-loaded and had a very core audience, and it was, you know, it's not going to get new audience. All of them drop 40% or less. There's very few of them. The Twilight Breaking Dawn, I think, dropped 51%. All the rest of them drop under 50%, even off of a big weekend with $150 million opening weekend. So I think it's logical to assume, also considering that it made less than 10% of its weekend gross at midnights. So it's almost like the midnights are almost negligible in this whole thing. You could then, you know, so it's still going to have a standard drop off, but it'll probably be 40%, maybe less. And I don't think it's going to be matched. A lot of people are saying, we talked about this off the air. Everyone's like, oh, Dark Knight's going to beat it. And I don't think Dark Knight's going to beat
it. No, I don't think Dark Knight's going to beat it as well. I mean, I don't think Dark Knight is going to have a $200 million opening in a 3-day weekend. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's going to make a lot of money, but I don't think it's going to make Avengers money.
No.
That's the clear shock. If you would have asked me a couple months ago what was going to be the biggest movie of the summer, I would have said Dark Knight Rises easily, but yeah. Now it's for me, firmly, it's going to be the Avengers.
Well, and part of the other reason Dark Knight's on a, it's got the lower ground anyway, simply because it doesn't have the 3D. And it'll have the IMAX boost, but it's not going to have the 3D boost. And what was it? It was an uncanny number of 3D screens. There, you could find Avengers in 2D, but almost everywhere at least had one 3D screen going with it. So
yeah, and there definitely, there's more 3D screens in this country than there are IMAX screens.
Yeah,
and that's definitely going to maybe hinder Dark Knight Rises box office overall. I mean, the movie's going to make a lot of money. Don't get me wrong here, listeners. Dark Knight Rises is going to make a shit ton of money, but yeah. I really don't think it's going to be the Avengers.
I don't even know. I'm actually skeptical on whether the Dark Knight Rises is going to beat the Dark Knight's domestic take. I don't see it making $530 some million. It could. I wouldn't be like, it's not happening at all. It'd be like if you said to me, is Think Like a Man going to have a surge and then suddenly make 500? And I'd be like, I'm pretty sure that's not going to happen. But Dark Knight could, but I could see Dark Knight Rises. I think it's good for $400 million. I think it has a good shot at that. Also depends on how good the movie is. I think some people are, you know, overly confident of Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, how good the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it could be a bump. I mean, everybody can. I said this once about Rob Reiner. Somebody said to me back in when he was making movies like A Few Good Men. And that was all off of like When Harry Met Sally, and he'd done Misery, and he'd done all these fantastic films. And people were like, oh, he can do no wrong. And I'm like, no, he knows he can do wrong. And that's what's keeping him afloat. And he did North.
And then there's Alex and Emma, I believe. Yes, that was a movie he did as well.
He did that one.
But, yeah. But with the Christopher Nolan thing, with Dark Knight Rises, Dark Knight Rises is a completely different, or The Dark Knight is a completely different movie than what The Avengers is doing. And there are a lot of people out there saying, well, is it better than The Dark Knight? Well, The Avengers is a very different movie. I mean, I don't know if it has to be better than The Dark Knight to be a good movie.
Yeah.
When they're doing completely different things.
Yeah. Well, they're very different comic book movies. And so, I think we'll see what happens with The Dark Knight. And it does have, it's sort of like the last big movie of the summer. And it has like a couple weeks in July. But then, you know, we actually have a really crowded August. It used to be August was a dumping ground where they would put movies that had no chance of actually doing well. And they'll just shove them into August just because they're, you know, they need to get them released, and their movies used to not even make $100 million. But you've got Bourne Legacy, Total Recall, Expendables 2, all that kind of stuff. That's all coming in the first couple weeks of August. So there's similar movies that are going to compete with this. And I mean, right now you've had The Avengers, nothing. Everyone got out of his way last weekend. Dark Shadows isn't going to pull much of its box office. Then what is it? Men in Black? Or no, it's Battleship. Battleship will put a little bit of a dent in there, but I think, you know, Avengers is still gonna be going strong into June.
Yeah, well, in June we have Prometheus and Brave.
Yeah.
But I think that's about. I feel bad for The Amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't think that's gonna be. I actually don't think that's gonna be. I don't think that's gonna be that great of a movie. I think it's gonna be okay, but I don't think it's going to make that much money.
I don't think
considering The Avengers and Dark Knight Rises,
it's not going to make the level of the other Spider-Man movies. It's not going to make $400 million like the first one, and it's not going to make even the third one, which people resoundingly can't stand. That one did 300 and some million, like 320 million. It's not going to make those numbers.
But I think with the quality of the film too, I don't think it's going to be great. I think it's going to be okay to good, but I don't think it's going to be The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to, or The Avengers. I don't think it's going to be that kind of movie. I think it's going to be a very routine type of comic book movie.
Yeah. So what's your prediction for this weekend? Avengers number one, what do you think it's going to make? What do you think the box office is?
I'll go with $100 million. I think it's going to probably drop off by 50, maybe.
Yeah. Well,
maybe a little more.
I'm going to say it's going to take I would say it's probably going to be a good $110 million, which is slightly less than 50%. So it's maybe like 45% drop off. But I think that's a realistic thing, especially seeing it making $19 million on a Monday. I think that's a good shot. And I don't think Dark Shadows is going to take much of its audience. I think Dark Shadows will do fine. I think there's a lot of people who like Johnny Depp and Tim Burton. I mean, you can't forget the fact that I had an argument with one other critic tonight at the Dark Shadow screening. He's like, no one's going to see this movie. I'm like, are you kidding me? Alice in Wonderland did $115 million in like February or January on a weekend. And he's like, yeah, but this is totally different. I'm like, he's like, that one was aimed to kids. I'm like, this one's aimed to kids too. They're playing this on, you know, they're going for a PG-13 audience. They're not going for little kids, but I don't think Alice in Wonderland was going for little kids either. That's a creepy-ass movie.
Yeah.
So I think Dark Shadows is good for, I'd say 30 to 50 million. So I'm going to just middle ground it and say it'll be like 40 million weekend.
Oh, I don't think it's going to be that high. I think it's going to be like maybe 30
Okay.
30 to 40. Well, maybe to 40 would be the highest, but I think it's going to be on the lower end of that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll see. I mean, I think it'll do okay. It'll do modest, and then it'll make like $500 million overseas because it's Johnny Depp. Because that's what those foreigners like.
they love Johnny Depp.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to sound off about? Anything else you want to get off your chest? Anything you see trends happening in movies? As long as there's no predictions or spoilers or any talk at all about Prometheus.
Well, I'm looking forward to Prometheus. I mean, I haven't really seen that many trailers or footage. I saw the Happy Birthday David thing with Michael Fassbender.
Stop.
I'll stop there.
I said nothing about Prometheus.
I'm really looking forward to Prometheus, but I am kind of worried that movie is going to be more of an adventure than it is going to be like the first Alien movie, which really wasn't an adventure movie. And this movie kind of feels like it's going to be more of
Let's just stop talking about Prometheus. No, see, this is the thing.
I know you're looking forward to it.
No, because this is what happened is I started jumping everybody's shit about Avengers spoilers because the trailers are spoilery. There's stuff that happens in the trailers that are TV spots that are not necessarily spoilers as much as there's lines that are said or shots that you can see what's going on or you know what's happening. When I realize I'm like, this is going to be a good movie, I avoided it. I avoided anything. So even just mundane trailers and TV spots or even just tone and style, I avoid it. And I think I love the movie even more because of that. And I've been avoiding anything I can about Prometheus. I've not watched a trailer. I don't look at posters. I don't watch any of the viral videos. I don't. Whenever I see it going to be a Prometheus thing, I don't even read the headlines.
Like you, the only thing you know is the name of the movie,
yeah,
and who directed it.
Ridley
Scott. That's it.
Well, no, because literally, I went to go see Lockout. I think I told the story a week or two ago. I went to go see Lockout, a midnight show, and they were doing trailers, and it's a 20th Century Fox, and that didn't. And then I see this shot, and I'm like, oh, that looks like a neat shot. And then it goes from director Ridley Scott. I'm like, okay, and I walk out of the theater for about 2 minutes because. I'm like, I don't, and then people are like going, well, but the trailers, I go, don't tell me about the trailers because trailers are so spoilery. So I it's an experiment I'm trying, and I'll probably do this. I'm doing the same thing with The Dark Knight. I'm trying to avoid as much as possible because it reminded me of back in 2008 when Iron Man came out, Neil mm-hmm. Miller was doing the show regularly with me. He was running Film School Rejects, and so anytime there were stills or clips or whatever he had to put them on, he had to process them and put them on the website. And so it kind of became that flip book where then we went and saw Iron Man. I saw it with him, and after we saw Iron Man, getting in the car, and he's like, I said, well, what'd you think? He's like, it was good. It was kind of his response. And then later on, a week or so later, then he was excited about it. But I think it was just so anticlimactic for him because he pretty much saw the whole movie.
Yeah, I think that's kind of like the double-edged sword with people like us in our industry, that we love movies so much. We want to have the magic of the movie in the theater, but at the same time, we have to cover all this stuff. We have readers. We have to put out trailers. We have to put out stills, and we have to do all this research of the movie before it comes out. And so by the time we see the movie, it's probably not going to have that same kind of effect if we knew nothing about it at all. And it's kind of I think that's kind of a double-edged sword, that we have to kind of find the balance of knowing a lot about these movies, but at the same time still wanting to be excited about that magic in the theater.
And then there are some movies I don't care. I mean, if you got spoilers you want to drop about what to expect when you're expecting, knock yourself out. I am not at all worried about that film.
I mean, it's have we ever talked about this? Like that idea of when the first Phantom Menace trailer came out mm-hmm. and Darth Maul, his double-edged lightsaber came out, was in that first trailer.
Yeah.
And how awesome that was. Just think if that wasn't in the trailer and the first time you saw the double-edged lightsaber was in the movie.
You would have shit yourself right there.
Yeah, that would have been the coolest moment ever because he uses it at the end of the movie, not at the beginning, mm-hmm. you know. And
yeah, when he has the lightsaber, it's the first time he takes both blades out.
Yeah, so like when the first time that he does that would probably be the coolest moment ever if it wasn't in the trailer.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's something that's not necessarily – I wouldn't even call that a traditional spoiler, but it's just – there's so much, you can pack a lot of things in a 2-minute trailer. And also you're trying to, and I understand that I had a conversation with Drew Goddard about this, about Cabin in the Woods, where he's like, well, it's a trade-off, because you want to show people it's not just a typical horror movie. You want to show people what it's about. You're working against all these different things. And yeah, sometimes trailers can be your own worst enemy. And I said this on Facebook. I go, when it came to Avengers, and I was jumping all over people about spoilers. I'm like, it is sad that I'm a critic. I get to see movies usually several days to a couple weeks ahead of time, and I'm having to try and avoid spoilers from people from my own industry. You know, so
yeah.
That's why I like doing I don't do the movie news as much as I do the reviews, because then I can go see the movie and talk about it. So, but yeah, I think, anyways, was there anything else you want to talk about?
No, I'm pretty good.
Okay, cool.
I like talking about the kind of reaction you would have gotten if they didn't have the Darth Maul double-edged lightsaber.
Yeah.
If it wasn't in the trailer, as opposed to the first time you're seeing it was in the movie.
Well, you know what? One thing is, I saw The Matrix completely cold. I was not a film critic then. I was not in any sort of blogging. I don't think blogging was around then. And I'd seen one shot of one of the agents dodging bullets, like I was at a Best Buy or something like that, and I saw it on a commercial. But I'd heard people saying that this movie was good, and I said, well, let's go see it. So my wife and I went and saw it, and I like shit myself when he comes out, when he takes the pill, because I'm like, what the hell is going on? And then he wakes up in this tube, and I'm like, the shock you have when that. And I remember when I was a kid, my dad showed me Psycho. This shows how old this was. It was at a time where personal VCRs were extremely expensive and we didn't have one. So it was like really early 80s. But they, like, the library had them. And what you could do is you could go to the library and they had the movies and you could watch it there. Really odd. On just like a TV on a cart. But he showed me Psycho. And that's the first time I saw Psycho in like the worst environment imaginable.
In a library.
They're sitting in a library watching it, well lit. Just a tiny little screen and black and white. No, just kidding. It wasn't in a movie theater. It wasn't in any sort of good presentation format. And it still, when the end happens, I was just like, oh my God. And we've all seen that meme of the kids watching Empire Strikes Back for the first time. Have you seen that video?
Oh yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and you sit there and realize that. I remember when that happened in the theaters. I'm like, yeah, that's awesome. And my kids never got to experience that because they got introduced to the Lego sets, and of course, Anakin and Obi-Wan are characters in there. So you already go into the original movies knowing the history. So yeah, it's great to experience stuff, or like the chest bursting scene in the original Alien.
I didn't know about that when I first saw it. Because I was far too young to be watching a movie like that, and I had nightmares about that. And then I think later on, when Spaceballs came out, I think I was at an age where I can laugh at something like that.
Yeah. So I mean, those things are great, and it is great to experience stuff cold. And that's one of the reasons why, on one hand, I love being a film critic, so that I do get to see movies and experience some movies I experience totally cold, and that's really kind of cool. Not all of them, and some of them I see a lot of trailers for, and I got to cut trailers for when I do the show. I got to pull the trailer down, but it is neat to see them. It's nice to get that shock again. And I'm trying to do that this summer with a lot of the movies. Like I said, What to Expect When You're Expecting, spoil away.
I'm sure they're going to have babies at the end of that movie.
Babies might show up. So I'm not looking forward to that one. Anyways, let's do the Fat Guy Five. We've got five favorite cinematic vampires. And in honor, of course, of Dark Shadows. You know what was my favorite part of Dark Shadows? Was at the end when Nick Fury shows up and wants Barnabas Collin to join the Avengers. That didn't happen.
That would have been interesting.
Yeah. The first one was yours. Blade, you said. The Blade trilogy.
Yeah, I think Blade is actually a property I feel that should be rebooted. I feel like I would like to see more Blade movies. this is like another side of Marvel, you know, a really dark side. I love Guillermo del Toro and what he did with the series, at least with the first two Blade movies. I know he did the second one. Yeah. And I really feel like this is a property that's kind of ripe for a comeback. I can think of like Anthony Mackie, you know, if you remember him from The Hurt Locker or The Adjustment Bureau, he could probably play Blade, you know?
He could be cool. He just doesn't seem he I've never felt he's in that him being like imposing. He always seems small to me. And maybe it's cuz he is. I don't know. But I've never felt him being like Wesley Snipes he's always felt like he was built, you know. And Anthony Mackie always kind of felt like he's a little more of slighter stature, we'll say. I think if he bulked up, I think he could be really good. So,
but I think this is a series that's kind of ripe for a reboot, I feel.
As long as they don't give it to Neville Dean and Taylor, right?
Yes, I think that would just completely ruin. And I like Neville Dean and Taylor, but I don't know about that Ghost Rider movie.
The next one is just the classic vampire. Of course, you can't do any vampire without talking about Dracula. And I'm just going to pull two out here because I'm using Dracula and a lot of people have played Dracula. I mean, Frank Langella did and Gary Oldman. You can't beat the original Bela Lugosi simply because you talk about iconic characters. I mean, he was iconic in the 30s with that. And it's so iconic, he couldn't live it down himself. But also Nosferatu, which was made before the 1931 Dracula, but it was such a different version of Dracula. And it's not at all like Dracula is. But if you want to talk about imagery, that was fantastic. So the next one is another one from you, and that is From Dusk Till Dawn. The vampires from Dusk Till Dawn.
Yes, this is actually an example of a movie where I didn't know this was going to take this direction into just sheer horror, sheer into a horror movie. I mean, the movie starts off as kind of like a crime film, like a heist movie with these two criminals, played by George Clooney and Quentin Tarantino. But then it takes this turn into like just this batshit crazy horror film with vampires. I really didn't know. I didn't think this movie was going to go in that direction, and I applauded for going that crazy.
Do you know the story behind the script of that scene where it goes batshit crazy? Have you heard what actually was in the script?
No.
Apparently, no. Quentin Tarantino just wrote in the script that then the vampires appear, and then it goes, and all hell breaks loose. And in the movie, that 15 minutes of carnage is all hell breaking loose. It wasn't like, oh, this guy does this and this guy does this and this happens. No, it's just all hell breaks loose. And then it was just them making shit up when they were planning it and pre-production. So I think that's actually pretty funny.
Yeah.
What you get from this one line in a script and it turns into this sort of epic vampire battle.
But yeah, I think I just appreciate like just taking these two genre films and just like mashing it into one, and it works to a certain extent, and I think that's kind of a hard undertaking to do, to take two genres and make it into one cohesive movie.
Well, and if you look at where they ended up going eventually with their careers and doing Grindhouse, this was their original Grindhouse film, because it was two totally different movies styles in one, but they were both essentially exploitation films.
Yeah, and it works here in From Dusk Till Dawn. I don't think it works so well in Grindhouse. I don't know how you feel about that experience of Grindhouse or those two separate films, Planet Terror and Death Proof, but I feel it works better here in From Dusk Till Dawn.
My problem with – I loved Grindhouse when Grindhouse came out. I loved Grindhouse, did not like Death Proof that much. The reason I don't like Death Proof is I just felt it got just too talky, which is – I mean, people – and this is what I say about Quentin Tarantino. No one loves Quentin Tarantino dialogue more than Quentin Tarantino does.
That is true.
And so I think he just got a little extensive in it that it became so, and I think with that, by doing that, which is a very sort of artsy thing to do, for lack of a better term, it deviated from what a traditional grindhouse movie was. A grindhouse movie isn't, you know, a 10-minute scene with sharp, witty dialogue. It's a 2-minute scene with batshit terrible dialogue that then turns into a road flick or something like that.
Yeah, well, my thing with Grindhouse is I feel the worst enemy of Grindhouse was the budget. I feel that the movie cost far too much to make. If both of them would have made their movies for the price of what an actual Grindhouse movie cost, that would have been something interesting to see. Like, make these movies for $500,000 each or even less than that, and see what they could do as filmmakers, as writers, as to be creative with the filmmaking, what these filmmakers that made these Grindhouse movies had to be. And because they had practically unlimited budgets, you don't get the essence of a Grindhouse film. You don't get the essence of these B movies. You just get, well, of course they're going to make these movies this way because they had the budgets to. And I feel it would have been a better movie if the budgets were $500,000 each. But I don't think Quentin Tarantino or Robert Rodriguez could make a movie for $500,000.
No, I don't think
so. Not now, anyways.
Even for as much as Robert Rodriguez brags about how much cost cutting he does. I don't think he couldn't do an El Mariachi again, you know.
Exactly, and I think that's, for me anyways, that's the thing that suffers from Grindhouse. They were trying to recapture that experience and the spirit, but you know, it starts with a pocketbook for a movie like that. You know, the limitations of the budget had to be there, and it wasn't in these movies, and you can kind of feel that, you know?
Yeah. Well, and the other thing about, one of the things I loved about Grindhouse was the experience, the trailers, the bad film, all that stuff that I think completely confused a mainstream audience. But I wouldn't go see necessarily Grindhouse movies, but I've done dozens of movie marathons where you'll sit in a theater for 24 hours and watch, you know, 10 or 12 movies back to back, and they have cartoons and trailers, and you got old prints that looks like somebody spilled a Coke on it and then ran sandpaper through it. You know, I mean, it and there's a part of charm to seeing when you watch an old 35 millimeter trailer come up and you hear the scratches as it goes through the optical track. It's, even though that's imperfect, there's an organic thing to that. We talk about that. Actually, I just recently had on Second Reel, I had Joe Neff, who runs the marathons here in Columbus, and we're having a sci-fi marathon next weekend, 24 hours. He was talking about there's a organic feel to these 35 prints that people don't see because people are so. I mean, if you get a Blu-ray, I don't want that on a Blu-ray. But if I go to a movie, it's kind of neat to see an old print. You don't want to see one that's gone red and it's half of it's burned away because it's the celluloid type that just sets fire like crazy. But there is something to see one of those older prints. There's a nostalgia to it, especially someone like me who watched these trailers when they first ran in the 70s and 80s. So. Let's move on to the next one. The next one, number four, is Jerry Dandridge, favorite cinematic vampire. Not Colin Farrell. I'm talking about Chris Sarandon from the original Fright Night. A very Salem's Lot-esque kind of vampire, which is also a takeoff on Dracula, but a fantastic vampire that was still romantic and sexy before they went really insanely whiny and crappy with the Anne Rice vampires and then later Twilight vampires.
I have not seen Fright Night, either version of Fright Night.
Shame on you. The remake's not that
Do you remember, was it that just came out last summer, right? The remake?
Yeah, like in August, which was dumb.
Yeah, and you remember that, like the buzz on that was like, that was going to be a big movie, you know, like that and Conan the Barbarian. Those were going to be huge movies.
They weren't. They definitely were not. I did not like the remake, and I thought Colin Farrell was lame in it. But the original 1985 Fright Night, classic vampire. I mean, it's cheesy because it's 80s. But, that's funny. Everything, because I remember watching these movies in the 80s, the cheesy movie in the 80s. They weren't cheesy then. And you watch movies from the 90s, and they're cheesy for the 90s. But they weren't cheesy then. Can you imagine movies that we're seeing now? You're going to be like, you're going to, people are going to watch those in 20 years and be like, oh, that's so like 2012. It's so lame. The last one is, and I just only refer to her as the naked booby vampire in Life Force, played by Mathilda May. I don't know how you say her name, but she's like naked through a whole chunk of the movie and she is gloriously naked. So bravo for that one. You haven't seen that one either, have you?
No, no, but I'm adding it to my Netflix queue right now just because of the nakedness.
You're like, naked booby vampires. We'll have to check that one out. So, cool. With that, we're going to go to a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk DVDs. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. We are wrapping up the show here. We talked about the Avengers, we talked about Dark Shadows, we talked about vampires, we talked about... Well, Rudy started talking about Prometheus, and then I freaked out.
I apologize for that.
Yeah, we had... I apologize. I always get... I overreact on that one. I will let you know in June if it was worth it. So,
I guess it's now time for the world-famous DVD roundup.
That's right. We have the world famous DVD roundup. Thank you. You see, Rudy's on the show enough that I don't really have to prep him for that. What's really rough is when I always have the new guest and I have to say, well, you have to say this. And then I do this whipping sound and it's really cool. And you'd understand.
Yeah, I'm very well trained is what you're saying.
This is like the third or fourth times you've been on the show three or four times. It's always good to have Rudy here because Rudy's a pro and, you know, He knows the whole business, both the podcast and the movie review and the movie news business. So, but first, you had one you wanted to point out that's way more artistic than anything I ever watched.
Well, this movie, it's in the Criterion Collection. It's a French film. It's in black and white, but I feel it's 100% accessible. It's a very entertaining film, and I highly recommend anyone check it out. It's called La Haine, which is French for hate, the hate, I believe. And it takes place in Paris, but it's kind of like this gritty, dark, urban Paris, like definitely not the Paris we see in movies today. Like just that it's not very romantic at all. It has a lot to do with guns and drugs and these hoodlums. And I highly recommend it. It's such a fantastic, like kind of a crime film, but a very low budget one.
When was it made? What year was it
made? It was made in 1995. It's a fantastic film, and I highly recommend it. Criterion is reissuing it, and they're putting out a wonderful Blu-ray of it. And check it out; it's fantastic.
Awesome. And actually, you can always wait for don't Criterion go on sale periodically through Amazon or anything like that.
Yeah, every twice a year they have a 50% off sale. One during the summer. I know they have one with Barnes & Noble. So there's always opportunities to get Criterion DVDs and Blu-rays for really cheap. And awesome. Definitely take advantage of those sales when they happen.
And definitely always worth picking up a Criterion simply for the special features as well, because they always just load that stuff up.
Oh yeah.
The ones I'm going to recommend are the not at all close to a Criterion collection of Underworld Awakening.
Wait, give it some time. Give it some time.
Yeah, when they say, oh, the classic fourth film in this trilogy. This one, it's not that good. It's somewhat forgettable, but if you like the Underworld movies, you can check that out. There's also a drinking game I wrote for Film School Rejects on Film School Rejects that you can watch. And you can use that for actually any of the drinking, any of the Underworld films, just probably not The Rise of the Lycans because the characters are all different. There's also Mother's Day, which is by Darren Lynn Bousman, which is a remake of the 1980s sort of, you know, cautionary tale of rape, murder, and all that kind of stuff. There's The Vow, which is just as painful, which has Channing Tatum and Rachel McAdams, and they're trying to sort of spin them off of their success in the Nicholas Sparks movies. This one extremely well. This was the first. Do you know this was the first $100 million movie of 2000?
Yeah, it's not surprising. I don't think it was. I wasn't very surprised when this made a lot of money. I like Rachel McAdams. I haven't seen The Vow, but I was actually looking forward to seeing it. But I didn't get an invitation to see it, so I didn't. I think it would probably be sad to see a single guy go to this movie by himself. So I'll wait when it comes into my mail through Netflix.
There you go. Well, and if it were a comedy, both of them would have been so much better in it. And then there's Chuck season 5, which is out as the final season of Chuck. Not as good of an ending as I would have preferred, but you can also get the full 5 season. And then, of course, Tim and Eric's Billion Dollar Movie, which is really pretty funny. Even if you've never seen Tim and Eric's stuff, they do stuff on Adult Swim, and it's this wacky story of them trying to make a Hollywood movie and waste all the money, and then they're being chased by the producers, so they try to make $1 billion revitalizing a mall. It is out there, bizarre. It's not always funny, it's not always 100% on, but it's a pretty weird little funny movie with some great cameos in it. There's also and then there's the stinker of the week is Playback, which is Tim and Eric's is from Magnolia, or Magnet, and so that's a good one. And then Playback's the one that's not so good. Christian Slater's in it, and it's just one of those movies. It was so hard to watch because I just would get so bored with it that I just start. Oh, look, hey, maybe I should paint the walls green. I don't know. So I don't necessarily say that that one's a good one to get. But now for the review wrap up. We both, of course, as a post review of the Avengers, we both loved the Avengers. Totally rocks. Do you want my pull quote on Rotten Tomatoes? I told you that already because I'm repeating myself. It's late. But Dark Shadows, we both said kind of sucks, not just because we didn't like it that much. I think you liked it better than I did, but you wanted to give it the vampire rating.
Yeah, it kind of sucks.
Yeah. then next week we've got Battleship, The Dictator, and What to Expect When You're Expecting, hint, hint, there's going to be a baby in it. And that's about it. Rudy, you got about 30 seconds. Tell us where you are, who you are, and where to find you.
You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Rudy_Obias, R-U-D-I-E _ O-B-I-A-S. Shakya.com, where I'm the movies editor, and I'm also the host of the AutorCast, which could be found at AutorCast.com. And you can find everything that is Rudy at RudyObias.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on the show again. It's always great to have you. And we will talk to you later.
Like the show you just heard? Then head on over to FatGuysAtTheMovies.com to hear more. Fat Guys Network flagship show, Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The Idiot Boxers with Kevin and Merrill. Celluloid Spotlight with Merrill and Hash. And if you like any of what you hear, kick us a few bucks using the donation button on the sidebar. Or just leave us an iTunes review. Fat Guys Network is where the ooey-gooey podcasting goodness is at 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.